Okay, well, why don't we go ahead and get started?
Okay.
Helen Spohr has agreed to do the adoption subsidies training again. Thank you so much. And if everybody could just put their phones on mute and ask any questions at the end, because we'll be taping the training. So, Helen, take it away.
Okay, hi. For those of you who may be attending for the second time, thank you very much. If it's for the first time, just very briefly so you'll know who I am in Jacksonville, Florida, and I've been with Guardian Ad Litem for 2 years, and we started the permanency project here, and we were focusing exclusively on children whose parental rights had been terminated, and they were languishing in foster care. Either they were in identified adoptive homes and nothing was being done to get the adoptions finalized, or they're in unidentified homes, and we still are always in an ongoing process of trying to find new ways to recruit and find homes for these children. And as you can imagine, it's an ongoing challenge for us up here, and I'm sure that's true around the state. One of the things that we found that was very, very important in the permanency project is making sure that the children who are being adopted were getting all of the available adoption subsidies, particularly in medical cases. So when I was first asked to talk about this to everyone, I remember saying, well, you know, I can talk a lot, but I don't know if I can fill an hour talking about adoption subsidies. And there are just so many other aspects of foster care where money is an issue. In fact, someone told me I should rename this and call it Show Me the Money, because I am known for constantly looking for sources of funds, not only for the children, but certainly for their caregivers. So before we get started, because there's a considerable amount of information that was forwarded to everyone via email that we're going to be looking at today, let's take just a second and make sure that we've all got everything in the same order, because I'm going to try and do this in a chronological order. So the first document that I'm going to be talking about is called the Relative Caregiver Communication Form. So if you've printed this and have this in front of you, if you'll put that as your first document. And then I'm going to go right from that into an August 31st, 2005 memorandum. The subject line on it is Normalcy for Children in the Custody of the Department. The next document I'm going to talk about is a memorandum that actually I prepared, and it's dated November the 29th, 2005. And the subject line on that is Available Funds for Dependent Children. And that the focus on this is going to be the children who are in care and we don't necessarily have an identified adoptive home. Then we're going to shift gears a little bit, and your next document that you should have lined up will be a June 10th, 2005 letter that's written to Mr. Jim Adams, followed by a chart that was prepared by Andrea Hack in our office, the GAL office, that compares adoption versus long-term relative care. And while I understand that that terminology is no longer in the statute, and in fact I'm going to ask, and I'll cover this when we get that, maybe we can have an updated chart, but the numbers and the benefits that are available still apply. The long-term relative would just now take the place of that APLA option for permanency. The next document would be a May 17, 2005 letter that starts out on behalf of the Guardian Ad Litem program. Then that is also followed by an October 30th, 2006 letter regarding the adoption of Sylvia Jones. And let me just point out that all of these names have been changed. None of these are the real names. And then lastly, it's the Children and Families Operating Procedure 175-71. Didn't realize that it was going to print out the entire portion of that operating procedure, but it won't hurt. And then I will tell you, for the purposes of today, the exact pages on that we may want to refer to. If I'm going too fast or if something's not clear, I know that we're taping this, but don't hesitate to let me know or say, you know, Helen, would you repeat that? That's actually fine with me. So what I want to start with first is this relative caregiver communication form. What we see a lot up here in Duval County is there's a lack of referral by the family service counselors for the relatives to go and get this funding. The relatives would need to go to the Economic Self-Sufficiency Office in Duval County, and if you don't know where that is in your district, you may want to call your local DCF, if you've got a contact person there, or perhaps the district administrator, and find out where is your local Economic Self-Sufficiency Office, and then get your contact person there. this is all that is needed to get a relative set up for relative caregiver funds. So let's say we've got an aunt who's taken three, you know, of her nieces and nephews into her home. She's entitled, and I'm going to use Duval County numbers, and I'm assuming that they're pretty comparable around the state. But in Duval County, the relative caregiver rate is, and it's by age, but it starts out at $241 per month for the children. So this form needs to be completed by the family service counselors, but it's just this one-page form. And this is also found on the Department of Children and Families website, so it's very easy to print it out. And I will tell you that up here, we have started printing them out and keeping a supply of them in the courtroom so that if we ask at a status hearing if, you know, the relatives have already applied for or whether or not they're receiving relative caregiver funds, if the answer is no, then we can just ask, you know, the court administration, please, you know, hand us one of these so that we can give it to them. The critical part of this that must be completed is the date of adjudication for the child. It's very, very important to have the family services counselor include that information because that's the date that triggers the start of the funding. Another issue that we had come up, and our office was very happy with the result on this, we had a grandmother who had had three of her grandchildren for over 3 years. So the oldest child was approximately five, and then, of course, another child would be born and would be added to grandma's home, and then the baby was born. And she'd never received any relative caregiver funds because the worker did not know or did not know how to refer grandmother to the Economic Self-Sufficiency Office. We learned about this in November, and we got with our local self-sufficiency office.
Hello?
And they paid it. Excuse me? I'm sorry, I thought someone had a question. They paid it retroactive over 3 years. So ultimately, the amount of the relative caregiver funding that was paid to this grandmother was almost $7,000. She got her payment the first week in December, adopted the children the second week in December, and as you can imagine, that made for a really nice Christmas for this family. So I always ask, please make sure when someone's referred to relative caregiver for application, to not necessarily say, can we please get it retroactive, to just say yes, and it needs to be retroactive to this date. So take a real, you know, strong position on that. We were able recently to get our local economic self-sufficiency supervisor to state in open court on the record that it is retroactive. So just don't forget that. Just because there's been a failure to get it done, if you've got the date of adjudication, it goes retroactive to that date, and that's certainly very helpful to these families. Please note that if bio mom or dad move back into the home at any time, the relative caregiver is suspended. If you've got a situation where the parents are moving in and out of the family a lot, they need to keep really close records of that because they will not pay relative caregiver if my bio mom and dad are in the home. And then the question comes up frequently about child support. If the parents are paying child support, the department is supposed to make arrangements to get that credited back to the department. It's been our experience up here that that's not happening very much. But, you know, just keep that in the back of your mind, too, that there's still situations where they're paying child support and receiving relative caregiver, but that's kind of an offset that's supposed to occur within the department. Because many times the parents are paying the child support into a depository. So there is someone within DCF who's supposed to be taking care of that. It's my understanding it's the revenue maximization people are supposed to be monitoring those accounts. So I guess the point for me on this relative caregiver communication is I was really kind of surprised at how simple it is. It's just one page. It's one page per child, but that's all that it takes to get this started. If there aren't any questions on that, I'm going to move ahead now to this August 31st, 2005 memorandum. Now, you'll note that this was written by Secretary Haiti. The subject line is normalcy for children in the custody of the department. Now, since Secretary Butterworth has taken over, we haven't seen a new memorandum like this, and, you know, it probably wouldn't be necessarily such a bad idea if perhaps Guardian Ad Litem wants to, you know, get with his office eventually once he gets settled in and ask if he's going to adopt this or modify it or, you know, I would be surprised if he would say he was not going to certainly carry on the intent of this document. This I'm not going to read the entire thing. It's quite lengthy, but We were very, very pleased when this came out because it puts in no uncertain terms the expectations of the foster parents and their duties to the foster children. If you will look on the second page, the middle of the document, it states the foster parent responsibilities to the child, to treat the child as if the child is their own, to ensure that child has supervision appropriate to his or her age and developmental level, to provide his or her monthly spending allowance, which is included in the board rate. So it lays out what I think we all know instinctively, but I always like to have things in writing. We've made great use up here in Duval County of this normalcy memo as it relates particularly to the children's monthly allowance. I'll get to that in just a moment. But this also has considerable impact for our teenagers. We've had so many problems for teenagers up here, everything from children wanting to go to the prom, where we've hit encounters where people will say, no, they can't go. We don't have background screens on who they're going with, who's going to be there. We had a situation where we arranged for sleepaway camp for one of our teenage boys, and the family service counselor came in and said, well, no, he can't go to camp because we're going to have to background screen every person in the camp. Well, that's ridiculous. The children in foster care are not being treated like normal children, and this memo from Secretary Haley was supposed to even that out. So I actually keep a copy of this in my notebook that I take to court every time I'm there when we hit this type of snag. No wonder children in foster care don't want to ask to go to a sleepover or do any of the things. This also, they were making this argument if the child was on a sports team and they were going to be traveling out of Jacksonville to participate in a sporting event. Well, the teenagers are starting to give up. They're too embarrassed. Who wants to have to, you know, go and say, well, would you mind having everyone in your family background screen so I can spend the night or so that I can go and participate in a sporting event? So we use this quite frequently, but I do believe that we need to get Secretary Butterworth or someone from the office, now that he is in charge, to adopt this, update it or whatever, so that at least it's current as to the new secretary. The last part is very important to me. If you'll turn to page 4, and I'll tell you why. The last bullet point, which says children in the custody of the department should receive an allowance no less frequently than each month, with the amount to be determined by the current board rate schedule. The out-of-home caregiver must not expect the child to use this allowance for purchasing personal hygiene items, school supplies, or other necessities. Allowances may not be withheld as a form of discipline. We've incorporated this language, and we now create orders for the judge's signature when we learn from our teenagers that they're not getting any of this. If we have a situation where your volunteer or your case coordinator is coming back and saying, you know, they don't have shampoo, they don't have toothpaste, they don't have any of the basic necessities, we will go in and report this at the status hearing and ask the judge to order it. And I do have a copy of an order that I've created, and I'm happy to send that around if anyone needs it. It's very, very simple, and it tracks this language, and then it also tracks the document that we're going to be talking about next, where we actually lay it out dollar-wise exactly how this money is to be provided by the foster parents. We have a problem here. I don't know if it's statewide, where foster parents who will take teenagers, and so we'll have a home with six teenagers, essentially will say, we're not going to give you any money, and we don't care what anyone says, and that's why we had to resort to having it reduced to an order, where if they want to come into the court and explain to the judge why they're violating a court order by not giving the children their monthly allowances, then they're certainly welcome to do that. So far, we haven't had that problem, but that's how far we had to go to get this done. If you'll look at the third document, which is the memorandum dated November 29, 2005, this is just a little chart that I created that kind of keeps all of this information right in front of you. I keep it actually on a bulletin board because I get so many calls about this. But what you'll see is this is the breakdown of the monthly foster board payment per age. So you'll see if a child's 0 to 5, the current board rate is $369 per month. And then there's the breakdown that I was talking about. A child's allowance at that age would be $10 per month. They're allowed $8 for incidentals, $35 a month for clothing. And then you'll see how it applies to a 6 to 12-year-old and a 13-year-old and older. There was a time when Duval County, in an effort to get more foster parents to take teenagers, we were actually paying $564 per month in board rate. But we, probably a year or so ago, they changed their minds and brought us back into compliance with the rest of the state. But for the teenagers, you can see for the 13 and up, this is, you know, it's a considerable amount of money for a foster child, where their monthly allowance is 12, their incidentals are 11, but it's $43 a month for clothing. So we break that out in the order and say that the foster parent, I believe that comes up to $66, if my math is right, and we track this language, we track the language from the normalcy memo, and then have that order given to the foster parent so we can make sure that the children are getting the funds that they're entitled to. Please note that children in foster care also get clothing allowances. They get a clothing allowance when they're initially detained, and then they get two additional clothing allowances during the year. So if you've got a teenager in particular who's saying, you know, I don't have any clothes, you know, school is starting soon, typically the back-to-school payment comes out in August. So please make sure that they're getting their clothing allowances. And as you can see, and I haven't heard anything to the contrary, it gives you the initial clothing allowance, which is 50 for a child that's 5 and under, 50 for children 6 to 12, and then 70 for 13 and older, and then the annual school clothing allowance. And one of the biggest problems that we see, and I know that everyone else must see it, is if we have a child who changes placements frequently, their clothes don't seem to follow them. Their clothes get left behind, or if the child goes on runaway, all of their belongings are gone. We do try and help the children get, you know, get clothing, but it makes it very hard. I have not had a tremendous amount of success on getting them to continue to resupply the children with clothing, particularly if they run. The position, at least up here, is, you know, if you're running away, you're leaving all of your things at your own peril, and it's a very difficult situation. In fact, I was in court this morning on that very issue. The judges do occasionally pick up the phone and call our lead agency up here, Family Support Services, and say, you know, can you please make arrangements to get the children some clothing? And they'll help, but that argument does seem to be wearing thin, that, you know, when we're constantly coming back asking for clothing allowance, because as many of you know, $300 for a teenager doesn't go very far these days. So it's an issue. I wish we could get that amount enhanced. It doesn't go very far and certainly impacts the children's self-esteem. If a family elects to adopt a child, they will receive 80% of this foster care board rate as the adoption subsidy rate. Now, that's if there are no factors as medical factors and occasionally behavioral factors, but we'll touch on that in just a few minutes. And then also, this chart gives you the relative caregiver payment, that first document that we discussed. This is the breakdown in Duval County for age. So if you've got a child, relative caregiver, like I used my example before, you've got an aunt that has nieces and nephews, depending on the age, this is the amount that the relative caregiver will receive per child. Now, Florida does not pay relative caregivers outside the state of Florida. So if the children are placed in Georgia, for example, with relatives, there is no relative caregiver. So they are really, you know, in my personal opinion, stepping up to the plate there, because they're not getting any financial assistance until they adopt. Now, when an outside of the state of Florida family adopts a child, now Florida does pay the adoption subsidy, but as I'm sure many of you know, if you encounter the interstate compact snags, this can go on for quite some time, and that's why it's very important, I believe, for guardian ad litem to do everything we can to try and push that ICPC process, and I'll show you what we're doing up here. It's been somewhat successful, and, you know, we're making some headways, but ICPC is a meeting and a presentation and a CLE, all of its own. But anyway, we have been trying to tackle that problem, and I'll get to that in just a minute. And I know we're taping, but if anyone has any questions or if I'm going too fast or if this isn't making sense, don't hesitate to stop me and let me know. I'm going to shift gears just a little bit now to adoption, because what I've been talking about up until now is children either in relative placement and in foster care, and typically the goal is still going to be reunification. But now let's shift gears, and let's say we've got a termination of parental rights, and now we need to be looking towards adoption. The letter that's dated June 10th, 2005 is a letter that I created a month after I started this position, when I started seeing a problem with getting a full amount of an adoption subsidy that we thought the children were entitled to. This is an unusually long letter for me. I don't usually do this, but because I was new in this position and I felt like I wanted Jim Adams, that is his real name. He is the chief executive officer for our lead agency. And let me explain very briefly here. In Duval County, I think we're a little bit different from everyone else in the state. When privatization went into effect, the department in Duval County subcontracted with Family Support Services to provide the care for the children. But then Family Support Services turned around at that time and subcontracted again. And at one time, we had 8 community-based care providers that were assigned throughout Duval County by zip code. We've now collapsed that down to 5. So see, we still have 5 community-based care providers all under the umbrella of Family Support Services. So on behalf of this child that I wrote this letter on, I decided to just go straight to Mr. Adams just to kind of let him know where we were going to be coming from if there had been a denial of a full adoption subsidy. I certainly will not read this entire letter to you, but I just kind of wanted to cite to, and you've got all of these in the materials that are provided today, cite to the Children and Families Operating Procedure. Kind of wanted to let him know where we were coming from as far as the case law that applies in the first DCA. You'll see that on the second page, which is the Greenfield case. But I know that every circuit will have a similar case that will be controlling on them. So if you elect to even use this letter, modify it, shorten it, this is just kind of a good launching part, or launching pad, rather, for making this argument for a complete subsidy for a child. And in this case, what we were asking was that they not reduce it back to the 80%, but to pay this child the full 100% of the board rate that the foster parents had been receiving. And I'll just, you know, let you read that through at your leisure. You may want to, if you're, you know, just starting out, I know several of the circuits are kind of patterning after the permanency project, this probably isn't a bad idea to just draft a similar letter to your lead agency just to kind of let them know that you're looking at all of these post-TPR through adoption cases, that you're going to be monitoring them, and that you're going to be looking, you know, for issues like this and just kind of lay it out. I haven't had to write as many of these letters as I did when I first did this one. I did have to do it a couple more times, kept attaching, you know, pertinent information about the case. And now it's kind of changed, and typically now I pick up the phone and talk to Family Support Services. But because I was new, kind of just wanted to let everyone know where we were coming from. This was that original letter that we drafted. The next document is the one that's entitled Financial Aspects of Adoption versus Long-Term Relative Care. And as I said, this was prepared by Andrea Hack from Guardian Ad Litem. This has been excellent. We even have our case coordinators and our volunteers ask for copies of this, because if they're visiting with the families on their cases, and the relative may say, well, you know, why would I want to adopt? What are the differences? A lot of people have asked for this information. This is very, very helpful. This is an excellent document. And what Richard, the director here, and I were talking about just this week is asking, I'm not quite sure who in Tallahassee, so I don't want to name a name and put someone on the hook here, but if we could get a similar chart now that the permanency options have changed that lay out, you know, adoption versus APLA versus independent living, this would be very, very helpful. I know that the judges like it. Everyone, this has been an unusually helpful document. I encourage you to, you know, study it and take a look at it, because it answers almost every single question that would come up if someone were considering adoption, the pros and cons, why this is a good idea, why it isn't. And I will tell you an interesting thing that has started happening in Duval County, too, is now the judge has started ordering us to mediation if a foster parent or relative kind of seems to be going back and forth on adoption. So, for example, at one adoption status hearing, they'll say, yeah, we think we want to do this. We come back in 2 weeks or a month. Then they're not sure, and then they have questions. Well, now the judges are ordering us to mediation to sit down with the hopefully prospective adoptive parent to talk about what is it you're concerned about. We had a mediation like that on Tuesday of this week, and I was really very surprised that after probably a 7-month period, the caregiver, the prospective adoptive parent, had never even been told about tuition vouchers for the child for college. It was amazing the things that they still had not been told. Well, no wonder they couldn't make up their minds. They weren't told about post-adoption services, because that's a big factor if someone's considering adopting a teenager. They're a little anxious. If the teenager has, gotten into their home, their behaviors have calmed down, but they're still having problems at school, everything hasn't completely ironed out yet, they do have anxieties. I don't doubt, in particular in this case that I was mediating on Tuesday, I didn't doubt for a moment this mom and dad's commitment to this teenage child, but they still had anxieties. And so I will tell you, we came away from that mediation feeling pretty good about answering all of the parents' questions, or the adoptive parents, and letting them know that, the day that order, final order of adoption is entered, we're not going to cut them off, that, there's still a whole host of resources out there. So I would encourage you to give this document to your volunteers and to your case coordinators so that they can answer questions when they're doing home visits, because it's very, very helpful, and they can certainly make a copy and leave it with the family if they want to sit down and review it. And I think this is a very, very helpful document. The next letter is dated May 17th, 2005. This is one that I created, really, obviously you can see, like 2 weeks after I started here, because one of the big problems that we were seeing for cases where we had an identified placement is the prospective adoptive parents were not being referred to the contract attorneys who handle the adoptions, the attorneys who file the petition, who help negotiate the subsidies, and we couldn't figure out what the problem was. We finally learned that they weren't being told to select the attorney until the absolute 11th hour, because the minute the attorney is selected and the petition is filed, well, a different clock is running. So it was much easier for everyone involved to hold that off to last, so they would kind of get around to it when they were ready. Well, we created this letter, and my case coordinators up here were doing an exceptional job of giving me the names of the prospective adoptive parents. We send this letter out. I don't have to do it quite as much as I used to. Occasionally I will. We would send this letter to the prospective adoptive parents, and we would include the list of Jacksonville lawyers who handle these adoptions. And in Jacksonville, there were originally about 8 or 9 lawyers. Now we're trying to open that up. Now there are about 15 or 16 attorneys who are familiar with handling adoptions for children who have been in care. They're familiar with negotiating enhanced subsidies. You need to be careful and make sure that the attorneys who might do this have some experience with this, because there are pitfalls, or that they have someone to call. We just had a situation here where a family was adopting, very lengthy case. The child's case had gone up on appeal. It came back down. Well, finally, it came time to finalize his adoption, and understandably, they wanted a very good friend of theirs who was a private practice attorney who does a lot of insurance defense to handle the adoption. And they called me and they said, Helen, don't you think he'll be able to do that? Well, I happen to know this lawyer. He's an excellent lawyer. And I said, I don't doubt his abilities as an attorney. I said, but this is a different arena. So I asked one of the attorneys who was on the list if it would be okay if she would just kind of look over his shoulder and walk this through, just to make sure that nothing could go wrong on this case, because first of all, it had taken years to get it to this point. And she agreed to do that, and it went just fine. But I would just be a little hesitant if an attorney doesn't have any experience with an adoption from a child who had been in care, kind of launching into that without someone looking over their shoulder to make sure that the judge's packets are the way that they're used to having them done, that they get all the documents to the lead agency for the approval of the subsidy amount, just so we're not missing anything. Because once that's done, we cannot go back. Once the adoption subsidy amounts are agreed upon and everything, that is set in stone, so you certainly don't want to mess that up and, not be able to go back and correct that, because the court will then have terminated jurisdiction, and that would be a big problem. But this is a letter that we send out, and it's been very helpful. We've got a lot of, reaction from that, a lot of people, calling, confirming that, yes, now we've got our lawyer, and it'll move much faster if you can get that lawyer on board as quickly as possible. They're very, very helpful. And I actually enjoy working with them a lot, and we work together as a team to get these adoptions done. The next letter that you're going to see is the October 30th, 2006 letter. Now, this is something that's kind of unusual, and we don't hear a lot of people who are doing this. We, at the request of the judges, write to the governors of the states on ICTC cases. If we have a situation where we have a child placed in Virginia or New York or wherever, and the family service counselors or the adoption specialists are coming into court and reporting, we can't get anything done, we can't get anyone in the receiving state to go out and do the final home study, you know, there's a snag on the paperwork, and I'm not going to belabor the ICPC process because I think most of you probably have a working knowledge, but it is a maze. It is incredible the way the information has to go through the channels, and it just goes back and forth and back and forth through Tallahassee. We are still struck by the fact, apparently, you are prohibited from calling Tallahassee ICPC and asking them any questions, which is very frustrating on this end. So what we have done is we bypass that and write directly to the governors of the state, giving them as much information as we can. We've had pretty tremendous success with this. If you, the more information you put in the letter, the more response you're going to get. And it, as somebody point out, this goes for the judge's signature. So if you're at an adoption status hearing on an ICPC case and nothing is happening, you may want to suggest, Your Honor, I'm willing to draft a letter to the governor of that state for your signature. Your judge, if, particularly if they know Judge Gooding, they'll probably say, okay, well, let's give that a try. You'll draft a letter that looks something like this, you know, certainly copy all the attorneys who are involved in the case, send it to your judge. They will print it on their letterhead and send it, and then, you know, see what kind of reaction you get. And I would love to get feedback on that. If any of you do that and have a great success story, I would certainly like to hear about that. That's been very, very helpful. And in fact, I need to go back to my desk after this and do two governors on cases of my own. But I will tell you that I do call the local ICPC specialists and give them a heads up. Sometimes I'm hoping that they will work with us without having to do this. And I haven't had a great response to that, though. I've had a number of people say, fine, you can write to the governor if you want to. And I'm actually trying to be helpful. So I do call first. You don't have to. But I do kind of tell them that this is what we have been ordered to do. And I just, you know, want to make sure that they're, you know, aware of this case. They are, you know, aware of what's going on in the issues. Is there anything that they want me to know before I draft this letter? And I would encourage you to at least give them a heads up if you're inclined to do that. The last packet of information is, it printed out huge. I probably should have designated certain pages. It's the Children and Families Operating Procedures 175-71. And this is very, very comprehensive. There are a lot of documents in here that will be helpful to you as you're working through this maze for children, finalizing the adoptions and making sure they're getting the maximum adoption subsidies that they're entitled to. But what I want you to flip through, and I'll give you just a second, it's probably three-quarters of the page way through all these documents, is document 5-2. The title on it is the Universal Title IV Eligibility Requirements. This is the portion of the operating procedure that I referred to in that May letter to Jim Adams. And I include this every time I have to write a letter just to show that the child that I'm writing on does meet these 4E eligibility requirements. It's a three-part test. Under number one, the child has to be, the parental rights have to be terminated. Well, that's usually a given by the time it gets to me. Number two are these specific factors or conditions that must exist that make it reasonable to conclude that the child cannot be placed for adoption without providing assistance. And I just want to point out something that's very important here, and it may be a split-hair issue, but I think it's very important. Please note that all of these factors do not have to be present. This is or. So even one of the presence of any of these factors makes the child eligible as long as they meet one, which is TPR, any of the factors on two, and then lastly, number three, that they've had to have made a reasonable but unsuccessful effort to place the child without adoption subsidy. So if you are, you know, going to either call or sit down, if you're going to a mediation, if your judges are ordering you that, you may want to have this document with you just to show that your child or children absolutely meet the criteria for Title IV-E eligibility for adoption subsidies. But what I noticed when I printed this out, which is something that I also think I'm a big checklist fan, as those of you who know me know, the very last page is excellent. It's a Title IV-E adoption subsidy checklist. Not a bad idea to just kind of run through this on your own cases just to make sure is anything missing. That way, if you're at a status hearing and you look at this and you may just want to say, you know, Your Honor, we just want to confirm that, you know, I'm just scanning through here, that there's been a subsidized adoption disposition sheet done. So you can kind of work as a partnership with your adoption specialist, with your agency, just to make sure that everything's there, or there's not something that you could help get. I don't have any qualms with doing that. If we're asking for an enhanced medical subsidy for a child, and that's going to be my last thing I'm going to discuss, I'll do anything that will help get a child an enhanced medical subsidy. There is a complete separate process that you have to go through. Once again, in Duval County, the maximum amount that our lead agency can approve without having to go to Tallahassee for a medical child is $444 per month. I don't know that that's the same for your area, so you may want to consult with your lead agency to confirm that. However, if you have a child who has significant medical needs and you've got a family who wants to adopt that child, it's absolutely, in my opinion, prudent. You should do it. Don't rush forward to an adoption until you have negotiated an enhanced medical subsidy. What you'll need is a diagnosis and a prognosis from the child's treating physician or physicians. That information is put into a packet with the child's history. It's given to your lead agency, and they it's actually a form. They complete a form that requests an enhancement. That has to go to Tallahassee. That has to be signed by, well, actually the ones I've seen were signed by Secretary Hady, so I'm assuming Secretary Butterworth will have to do the same thing. We're having great success with them turning them around pretty quickly. The longest we see is about a month. But please don't hesitate to do or offer to do anything that, you know, we can do to help put that medical information together. It absolutely benefits the child. I can't imagine going forward on an adoption for a child with severe medical needs without having done that. You may want to request a mediation if it's a child where the prognosis is unclear. So if it's not certain whether the child will have to come back for future surgeries, sit down and mediate it and get it in writing with your lead agency that if 4, 5, 6 months from now there's a situation where the child might need surgery, that the family can come back and say, yes, we mediated that, we agreed to that, we will, family support, well, I'll use family support services because they're ours, the lead agency, yes, we will assist you, you know, with surgical needs, nurses, aftercare, that sort of thing, so that you're not walking away and, you know, leaving the child in a situation where their financial needs can't be met based on their medical condition. And that's actually my closing. I feel like I've run a little bit long this time, but just don't overlook those medical cases because it's critical to that child to make sure that they're getting all of the medical subsidies that they're entitled to. Okay, questions?
Well, thank you very much.